Session number 101, 12, reel 5.
Mr. Thompson, reel 5.
And part of this document reads, this is a translation from the Kikuyu. We tried, after we captured it, to tie up the incident mentioned with those we knew about. They didn't always tie up, but it's just of interest. And here's the quote. Afterwards, we were chased from our camp at Makiyama by the aeroplanes, by the King's African Rifles and the police and the Home Guards. The camp was known as Wanjiru Camp, and we called the KR Plumes because of the plumes on their helmets. And then we shifted to a new camp at Gikumbu, but we were routed from here by tracer aeroplanes on the 12th of the 9th, 53. So when we saw the aeroplanes, we all slept at different parts. During the month of September, we were attacked by the King's African Rifles many times and the RAF in various parts of the forest. We were greatly molested in this month. And on the 29th of the 9th, they were heavily bombarded by the RAF bombers. So they scattered, and some people came into the reserve and began to trouble people. In this, our leaders were Major Maruri and Captain Wangi Kabogo and Mbugwa Njuguna. And because of that dispersing, we elected a committee of elders to consider why some people were deserting the gang. So, as I say, we had the planes bombarding them. The Kenya regiment and British regiments were also combing the forests. But in the forests immediately above our own areas, we started to form special patrols of very good tribal police and Kikuyu guard. And they, together with young soldiers as their leaders, would go up into the forest for days, indeed even weeks at a time, chasing the gangs. And they had many, many successes, very good successes. Not only fighting, but just breaking up the gangs and chasing them out or chasing them towards our forest edge patrols. And so we began to wear the gangs down. Now, the moment that the gangs began to lose their power over the people and that oathing became less prevalent, the people began to talk a little. And the first things we discovered were the names of the people who had done the beating up. The thugs, the askari of these oathing gangs. People don't like being beaten up. And this led us to a new and very difficult problem indeed. Now, right from the very beginning of the emergency, we had had to arrest people, but we had to put them in detention, hold them there, because although we knew they were bad, we knew that we had evidence against them, the evidence was not hard enough to take them to court and imprison them. They had to be detained, put in detention camps, kept away from their own people. And once we started to really get at the gangs, we began to pick up detainable people in vast quantities. Now, let me give you an example of why sometimes you have to detain rather than prosecute. And this comes from an actual case which I was attending because there had been a very big attack on one of the villages in my area, a loyalist village, when Mau Mau had killed, I think it was 27 people, including about 11 children. And these kids had been hacked to bits and in appalling circumstances. Well, we capture some of the gang, and the local people tell us that these gangsters were those who had raided this particular village. So we take one or two of them to trial. And I remember a cross-examination in court which went something like this. To the witness, you see. Now, you say you saw this man in your village on the night of the attack. Yes, I did. But it was 11 o'clock at night, wasn't it? And there was no moon. That's right. Well, then how did you see him? Oh, I saw him by the light of the blazing huts. I bet there was a lot of smoke then, wasn't there? Oh, yes, there's a lot of smoke. But you did see him. Oh, yes. Could you swear to it? I saw him. Now, imagine that, say, the advocate there, turning to the judge before the summing up in the final address, and said, "You will appreciate, my lord, that the evidence here is based on a person, comes from a person who at the time was in panic, running around, and what he saw was in the midst of a lot of smoke and flame. And you can see that immediately your case collapses." Now, if your case collapses and all these accused get freed and sent back, the locals say, "What the hell is the government doing?" And so you find yourself in a situation where you have to detain them. Now, some, like Kenyatta, and leading politicians, or leading KCA people, had been detained from the very beginning of the emergency. And then other organisers had been picked up, and the number of people in detention were getting greater and greater. But once we started to fragment the gangs, then the numbers in detention really did grow. Now, we had three kinds of detention camp. We had what were known as the very bad ones. They were at three places outside Kikuyu, one at a place called Hola, another and two others in the coastal province. Manyani was one. I just forget the name of the other for the moment. And we had district ones, where we would hold people who were being a bit difficult but didn't probably have enough on them to get them into the big camps, and local area ones at divisional headquarters. I had one at Kandala. Now here we would take people who had come from the gangs or had been oathers but who had admitted their sins. But the local people say, "We're not going to have them back." And so I would hold them on a detention order, during which time they played a lot of football, frankly. They did PT, and I don't mean PT in the sense of disciplining PT, PT for pleasure I'm talking about. They would help to build huts, make roads, light work, in other words, and lived in huts behind two or three strands of barbed wire, no more. And local people could see them, local people and their families could bring them food. And eventually the local people would begin to trust them. They would chat through the wire or chat when out on jobs or when playing football. And they would begin to local people. So normally people at the divisional level were soon released back into life. People at district level a bit more difficult. Some would then get released down to the division for a bit of rehabilitation, or perhaps if they remained hard would be sent on to one of the big camps and so on. And later on Hola became infamous because of some mass deaths there, of which I had a lot to do, not with the deaths, but in the sorting out of the aftermath thereof. And all the time that we were de-oathing these people and they were coming forward with information, we come back to our card index and the building up of the massive file of information. And this, through this, we had this battle for hearts and minds. Now, I never believed, as I said earlier, that Mau Mau was something that had grown out of the Kikuyu Central Association. It was essentially Kikuyu, that it was not a nationalist organisation. It was a Kikuyu organisation. It was not fighting for independence. But there were one or two other African politicians, non-Kikuyu, who were astute enough to see that they could manipulate this Mau Mau situation to Kenyan African political advantage. Now, I've chosen those words very definitely. Kenyan African political advantage. Tom Mboya was one of these. And he had a lot of American backing. He travelled frequently to America and spoke in America. And just about this time, there was no doubt about it that money was coming from all over the world, and particularly from America, to back what was being known as freedom for Africans in Africa. And he began to wage a very clever campaign for the release of Kenyatta. And he built up Kenyatta to be the outstanding father figure, the man who was being badly treated by the British. In this, he had considerable help from Britain. Lord Fenner Brockway made no bones, as a Labour Member of Parliament, made no bones about his belief that Kenyatta should be immediately released. He made no bones about the fact that he believed that Kenyatta was an innocent man and had no part in this. And there were others. Mrs. Barbara Castle was one. Now, these are political beliefs. They believe this, and they were in the forefront of that group of British political thinkers who said the time has come to bring freedom to these colonialist territories. Now, there's nothing wrong in that. What I am saying here is that such people as Tom and Boyer, with American aid, American money, and British political muscle behind him, was in a very good position to manipulate the Kenyatta figure. What I don't think, this is again one of my own personal observations, what I think is that Boyer never realised just how powerful he would make Kenyatta become. I think Boyer always thought that he would run the country with Kenyatta's aid. It went the other way round, and Kenyatta eventually, as we know, became president, and it is said a very religious man. But that is something else which I will not comment on. About the same time, towards the end of 1953, I was posted away from this Kikuyu Mau Mau war up into the Nyanza province and eventually down into the coast province, which would put me... Sorry, could you stop? I think I rather messed up my dates and timescale here, because I keep referring to 1953. Well, the emergency started in 52. The first 6 to 8 months we were in a mess, which pushes us well into 53. Then we had a year in which Mau Mau and the gangs were all powerful, 53-54. And it wasn't really until 54-55 that we went on the counter-offensive. So I've just recently passed references to 1953. I'm a little on the wrong side. But by 1956, we had got it under control, but we had not finally convinced the people that they needed to get Mau Mau out of their hearts, that they needed to take a good look at themselves, pull themselves together and face up to the future ahead. What we did realise, however, was that all this time they'd been gaining in political consciousness. What had been a simple farming people had now been through a period of war, internal strife, hate within themselves. It was a civil war in many ways. They'd been killing each other, they'd been fighting each other, men had been fighting for their survival, and they could see also that it had weakened the government position. They'd also, because of the vast amount of propaganda which we had to push at them, learnt new names. I've referred to Fenner Brockway and Mrs. Castle. These were names known to them. They realised there were people outside who were interested in their future. And they were a new people by this time. We, I suppose, traded on the fact that they were tired of the civil war. We kept thrusting this down their throats. You're tired of this. Get away from it. Well, you can go on saying that, but you have to offer something else in its place. And I think we went through a period of great difficulty here. We ourselves were tired. The Kikuyu loyalists were exhausted, but sort of victorious. And we were milling around a little bit without knowing what was to come next. It was a very difficult period indeed.
You mean you were without an objective?
Without a clear objective. Eventually, it became... Well, it had become clear, but had to be put across, that the time had come for major change within the government of Kenya itself. The legislature obviously could not carry on as it had carried on. there had to be a large number of African members in the House. This led to a lot of infighting as to whether there should be as many African members as there were European members. Where did the Asians hang? Would there be a balance? And so on. And there was a period when colony-wide politics suddenly became paramount. Because if the Kikuyu were going to have representation, it was the Kikuyu who had made the noise, the other tribes who had behaved themselves and remained loyal also wanted a share. And it was at this point, about 1956, that the other tribes suddenly woke up to the fact that the political moves were in the air, and that if they did not wake up as tribal entities and demand a slice of the cake, they weren't going to get anywhere. Now, a very strange thing about the Kikuyu, about this emergency was, and it cost a hell of a lot of money, most of it had gone into Kikuyu land. Often, this was a multi-million pound war. That had gone into persuading the Kikuyu to do things, improving life in the Kikuyu areas, giving the Kikuyu guns, while the other tribes had been quiet, peaceable, had virtually got nothing. They would have had more schools if it hadn't been for the emergency. They would have had more doctors if it hadn't been for the emergency. So they knew they had to wake up. And so their political leaders, their tribal political leaders, started to demand a voice. So what better than a united voice? And this united voice was the Kenya African National Union. And because the Kikuyu were so clever and so powerful, who dominated the Kenya African National Union? The Kikuyu. And from this Kenya African National Union grew the party which was to take Kenya into independence, and which fought the first big election. Now, it's slightly away from Mau Mau, but I think it rounds it off a little bit if I just describe one of these African elections to you, because we're still faced with a largely illiterate populace. And I was now posted away from Kikuyu land. The first time in my entire administrative experience, I'm in another area. I'm right on the border with Uganda at a place called Bungoma in Elgin Nyanza, in the Nyanza province, when the first nationwide election came along. The election which was to give, for the first time, Kenya Africans a majority in their own elected government. And there were various parties in the field, a lot of minor parties. There was KADU, the Kenya African Democratic Union, which was a very moderate party. The Kenya African National Union, which was the Kenyatta hard, hefty, hard-hitting political party, the big one. And the number of candidates fielded was considerable. Now, if you've got an illiterate population, it's no good giving them ballot papers on which to put marks against names, because if they can't read the names, they can't make a mark, and some of them couldn't make a mark. So what you have to do is you have to give each party a symbol. Now, if I can put that in British terms, it would be that the Conservative Party would have an oil well as its symbol, the Labour Party would have a spade and trowel as its symbol, and the Liberal Party would have a flower for its symbol. And so you go along to the vote, to the ballot box, your name is recorded in the register, and you're given a ticket on which a date stamp is stamped, and you put that in the box which has the symbol marked on it. Well, the particular district I was in, I think we had 16 boxes because we had 16 candidates. Kenya African National Union was very clever. It chose the motor car as its symbol, and their candidates simply had to stamp the country saying vote for me and you get a motor car. So it is no wonder that they won the election hands down in most parts of Kenya. I think KADU I think, not at all sure now, had a cow. And they really did the same thing, vote for us and you'll get a cow, but obviously motor cars are preferable to cows. One outstanding memory I have of one polling station at a place called Marachi. When we came to, I was there when the ballot closed, and I was going to take the boxes back in my truck to the central counting place. And we had to provide additional ballot boxes because there were so many votes for Kanu, their box was overflowing. But when we came to sort them out, we also found that we had 26 votes, or about 26 votes, had been posted in the loudspeaker of the community hall radio set. The confusion of old and illiterate people who didn't know what was going on. But having said that, I mustn't leave the wrong or false impression. It was a very fair election, which was won with the party which had the power and which led to the government, which eventually saw Kenyatta, after his release as chief minister, and then the first Prime Minister of Kenya, and eventually governor.
Presumably, the ballot wasn't all that secret if they put their slip into different ballot boxes.
They were in curtained cubicles. Well, they're not curtained cubicles. The ballot boxes weren't behind curtains, and people went one at a time, sort of in one end behind the curtain and came out the other. As secret as it was possible to make it. By British standards, I would say a very unsecret election. But by the standards of the time, a very fair one, the best that we could possibly devise, and which had the support of the politicians themselves.
But what I'm getting at is, could pressure be put on people because others wouldn't know whom they had voted for?
Yes. But I think the pressure was already there. People had made up their mind where they were going to vote. There was a tremendous amount of politicking in Kenya in those days. I don't think in any way it would have affected any electoral result. And again, memory may be tricking me, but I don't even think it was a close result across the country. One or other of the candidates, and it was usually the Kanu candidate, had a very, very clear decision. What we did, the way you did it, most black people's hands are pale on the palm. They have pale, yellowy or pink palms. So what one did, when you came to vote, your name was checked against the poll tax register. We'd had to build up special registers because women didn't pay poll tax in Kenya. It was a male tax. And so we'd had to go around all the villages sending teams, listing everyone who lived in every single village to build up brand new electoral registers. So when you came along, let's say your name was Mamie Kanuthia from Gaturi village, they looked you up, and they then stamped a special electoral stamp and date mark on in indelible ink on your palm. So that you couldn't go through twice, you see. If you had that on your palm and your name ticked off in the register, and then you process one by yourself behind the curtain to find the ballot box of your choice. I think that was the best we could do. I don't think we could have improved on that.
Could I ask you some questions that have arisen in the course of you speaking?
Please do, because I think I've more or less come to the end of what I can say, unless I'm prompted.
Did you actually meet Jomo Kenyatta and get to know him?
Several times. I met Jomo Kenyatta before the emergency. He came to Fort Hall several times. The very first time was almost on the day of my arrival in Fort Hall itself, where he'd been visiting the district commissioner.
What was he like as a person to meet?
Polite. Pleasant. Different. I'm not going to use the word outstanding because I'm trying to set him again. I'm trying to think back to my days of being the puzzled young man being faced with an African tribe where they're all looking alike. Rather like the outstanding ornament on the mantelpiece, you'd said, ah, I think that's the better piece. He was very articulate. He had been in England, he'd got an English wife, he spoke English. Of course, on that first occasion, I saw him. I think he said good morning to me, no more than that. But he several times came to Fort Hall to see the district commissioner, to seek permission for meetings. And I watched him performing at some of the meetings, and he was an absolutely dynamic speaker. There was one meeting just before the emergency when he had a... I think it was the last one he was permitted to hold in Fort Hall. I remember it was outside the African Native Court, where he was speaking in Kikuyu, which I couldn't understand then, but I had an interpreter with me. In fact, yes, it was Julius and Googie and Doogie, the person I mentioned earlier. And we could hear this, and he had a loudspeaker or megaphone of some kind. It was very clear. And I remember him saying, "And we will hoist the flag of freedom." And his henchman held up the trunk of a banana tree. Now, they do this, you see, because we couldn't accuse them of hoisting an illegal flag. We couldn't say a banana tree was a flag. It was a symbol which was recognised by all those who supported Kenyatta. So the flag of freedom was a banana tree. And I remember him saying, "And we will water the tree with blood this day. We will water the tree with blood," and the crowd howled. And that same night, seven people who were known to be anti-Kenyatta or not supporting Kenyatta were hacked to death. And I remember their bodies coming in the truck into the Boma the very next morning. And he'd never condemn that sort of thing. And he would say this sort of thing, you see, "We will water the tree of freedom with blood. Not we'll go out and kill." You can say, "But it was my blood I was referring to." When it was ambiguous statements. He was very good at them. But he was an outstanding speaker.
What was the Mau Mau attitude towards Asians?
I don't think they had an attitude. They were conscious of this chap Appa Punt, the Asian commissioner, who was saying the right things as far as they're concerned. But his words were sweeter to the Tom and Boers of life, the other politicians sitting back who weren't involved in Mau Mau. In fact, if anything, Mau Mau was anti-Asian, because on the fringes of the Kikuyu districts, and at just one or two trading centres within them, but very few, Asians traded. And the African didn't like that. The Kikuyu didn't like that. And the Asians treated them very meanly. They would screw the last penny out of some old poor Kikuyu woman who was buying her salt or tea or a bit of maize meal. They weren't at all popular. And another thing was the Asians never employed Kikuyu or Africans in other than the most lowly of jobs. The jobs were kept for their own families. And the Africans, right to the end, used to say, and several Africans have said this to me, and an African who later became the first Kenya ambassador at Bonn, who was on my staff at one time,